Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here this evening on such a gorgeous night. We're really excited this evening to present two beautiful poets to read for us this evening. I want to tell you a little bit. I don't know if you know very much about the Poetry Center of Chicago, but we've been around for 37 years. And we started with a reading series. And our reading series is, I don't know if we still are, but we were one of the foremost reading series in Chicago. And we've had some of the most famous poets read for us over the years, from Allen Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. We've had poet laureates, Pulitzer Prize-winning poets. And so we pride ourselves on having some of the finest poets in the country reading for us. We have a program which sets us apart from other poetry organizations called Hands on Stanzas. It's a program that we have in the Chicago Public Schools. We provide poets in residence in the schools for 20-week sessions, and they go in and teach children how to read and write poetry, critical thinking, and creativity. It's one of the most special programs in the country. I think there are only, there may be two other organizations in the United States who do this. And it's vital because so many of the arts programs have been cut in the Chicago Public Schools. And so it's very important that we continue that. Having said that, I would urge you to consider becoming members of the Poetry Center, because we're a great organization, number one. Number two, many of the wonderful readings we have are free. And we've had some very special events. I don't know if you're familiar. A few weeks ago, Natalie Merchant, the singer, she just came out with her latest album after 7 years. She hadn't done an album in 7 years because she had a baby. And she took the work of 19th and 20th century poets, and she adapted it to music, and now they are all over the radio. And we were fortunate, we were one of the first organizations to host her. We were across the street at the Ribloff Auditorium at the Art Institute, and we basically had a sold-out event. It was really great. We also have been doing some very different things. I don't know if you're familiar with the art prints that we have. They're called broadsides. And they're limited edition prints of many of the poets who have read for us, and a poem with artwork. And we just did an exhibition at Art Chicago, which was very well received. We're very excited about that. And so we've been doing a lot of different things that many organizations haven't done in the poetry field, partially because so many people don't know enough about poetry, and they're not exposed to it enough in the right way. And so we're reaching out and trying to bring our poets and poetry to a wider audience, not just the little literary circles that we tend to mingle in. I think we all have a tendency to do that. So it's been an exciting experience. So having said all that, I'm going to introduce you to our first poet, Jenny Bouly. I'm very honored to be presenting her work. She's going to be reading today from her book, The Book of Beginnings and Endings. And Jenny is the author of the forthcoming, and I'll read a little bit about her bio, not merely because of the unknown that was stalking towards them. The Book of Beginnings and Endings, One Love Affair, The Body, an Essay, and a chapbook, Movable Types. Her work has been anthologized in The Next American Essay, The Best American Poetry, Language for a New Century, and Great American Prose Poems. Her work has been published in Boston Review, Gulf Coast, Fourth Genre, Columbia, Verse, Seneca Review, Conduit, and other places. She's currently a PhD candidate at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and holds previous graduate degrees in creative writing from the University of Notre Dame and Hollins University. She teaches in the nonfiction and poetry programs at Columbia College in Chicago. Jenny, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for coming out tonight. And I'd like to thank the Poetry Center for hosting Simone and I tonight. And I'd like to thank Simone for having me read with her tonight as a fellow Sarah Vann Press author. And because of that, I thought I'd read from my Sarah Vann book tonight, The Book of Beginnings and Endings. And for those of you who are not familiar with the conceit of the book, it's literally beginnings and endings. So I have first pages and last pages, but nothing in between. So you're looking at a book that's full of hypothetical first pages and last pages of books, and the beginnings and endings do not correlate. They're not like from the same book. So that you know if I'm reading an ending or a beginning, I'll let you know. I'll say this is a beginning, this is an ending. So the beginnings end abruptly. They may end mid-sentence. And the beginnings also may just pick up mid-sentence, or they may start on a sentence. This is a beginning, prologue. And if it were possible to pursue the bleeding heart dove to her nest, what then? It doesn't make sense for me to say, forgive. I'm naturally inclined to a daydreamy disposition and leave it all at that. There was more to it, to that story that I kept leaving out, the car so close, it almost. But some things were true. When I cry, it is, as I said, always in first person. At least now I understand the poem involving traffic lights. Symbols will always present accidents of themselves. When the bleeding heart dove flies into the cathedral's windows and falls out of favor with the skies, this is no accident. What it is the manner in which symbols will make themselves known. To begin and then end, it makes me fall out of favor with myself. The sky full of false surmises, the desert empty, I only exist elsewhere. Tell me what it is that you know about me, because you seem to think that I can save myself. Is it wrong to attribute to you all of my happiness? I kept falling out of use value. In the rain, the street lamps empty their pockets of change. If it were only possible to love without consequences, because sometimes I forget just where it is that I am. This, however, has no bearing on where it is that I am going. If I began to call the shots, it is because so many things have already been shattered. It was wrong of me to believe that you had invented your stories. Even the alluded to rocks were based on real rocks. And so the girl whom you met in the rain, who slipped suddenly into your car to say that she had always loved you, she was true. And therefore, from then on, up through London towers, over London bridges, through London mazes, you try but you fail to find her. I am thinking of a number from 1 to 10, and you are rowing a boat further and further from shore. If there were false surmises, it was I who embedded them into the locks, the open windows, the space of a jar. When you said we would read this book together, I assumed you meant it was the one that held. This is an ending. Coda. A flutter from this life to that life. The great space of in between, that unknowing of what then and what next. These were the reasons the ferryman gave for not departing, for not embarking, for not listening to his passengers say when. But really, what it was a love story. And that is why the door stays forever opening, why the lily was filmed as it was, forever closing. What matters is that at one time you came to me, or I came to you, and then what it was the space of a love affair that was little more than an infinite singularity, a space for heaving. This is a beginning. 1. My body wasn't taken with me, the soul being a very spacious thing. Our dreams were correct. Over time, we would come to discover independent yet certain truths. Discovery number 1, it is lonely. Discovery number 2, no matter what, you will never be privy to my diary. 3, even though the moon may be rising, there will be no spartica, no intervening ivy, no conscious oaks, no dowries, no contemplating orderlies, no oranges, no redeeming qualities. When you will leave incredibly softly. The cry of a whistle, a belly still heaving, I set the clock back every morning. I found myself along with the other absurd people taking pictures of animals at the zoo. The publishing houses give the dead authors contemporary book jackets to make it seem as if they were still living. Suddenly, so says Longfellow in his translation of Dante, you are no longer in the body of the text. The dash makes this clear. This is an ending. Commentator of this film explains that there exists such diversity among organisms, such distances in space-time, that, given evolution and progress, we can never know at any point in space-time the bulk of everything in existence. I love you and fear that astronomical discoveries eclipse me. Nevertheless, I keep on morphing and rearranging the scenery, placing things where I think only you will find them. I alone know the cause of plate tectonics is humanity's collective yearning to fit in. We cannot see atoms, the voiceover insists, yet they exist. If you develop an instrument that is highly sensitive, you can locate almost anything. I am not portrayed as the last survivor of a rare orchid species, nor am I a legendary cowslip possessing miraculous medicinal properties. Rather, I am a leaf cutter ant that, although oblivious to its object at the end of its trail, follows nevertheless with faith that it is being led to something, somewhere. Then I am a speckled spot projected onto the ceiling of a planetarium. Now a dusty gypsy moth, now as interstellar gas and dust, I am 13 million light years away from you. The film concludes by discussing the power of nuclear fission and fusion, and then the redemptive promise of reproduction. In the color of lifeless planets, in the color of dust, bright pollen, beauteous butterflies. And this is a beginning. It's from a book entitled An Introduction to Invertebrate Zoology. Preface. Before one can begin to study, one must realize that the most difficult task in invertebrate zoology is believing that these certain specimens are indeed alive, or at least alive in the sense that they are fauna and not, although they should seem so, flora. For instance, anemones, although they always appear to be beckoning, are not vegetation produced merely to hide small schools of fish. The sea cucumber certainly has been given a lay name to suggest that it is not an invertebrate. Starfish and sand dollars, of course, as all invertebrates, seem to want eyes and a mouth, some sort of face, which will help them to appear human. This is what makes it so difficult to ascribe the term alive to invertebrate. Their seemingly indifference caused by a lack of facial apparatus, which in turn makes it so that they are indeed vegetation. Coconuts certainly have afforded better treatment, simply because with their shaggy seed casings and those three dark eye spots, they resemble at best a confused old tribal man. Earthworms are easier to believe as being alive simply because we witness their struggle and death as hundreds are left to die on sidewalks during each spring rain. Certainly, our earliest memories of dissecting such a specimen in elementary school is enough to cause us to remember for all time that they certainly are alive. For instance, when I sit on my lover's face, I oftentimes experience a... And this is an ending. When old poets died, everyone assumed that they had, because of their reputation and statures, died long ago. It was difficult to acknowledge or mourn the passing of someone who had, although falsely and somewhat privately, already passed. The scholars made notes to reread the works of the twice-dead poet, but of course, never came around to actually doing so. No one could ever understand the appearance of the animals at the end of the famous poem, or why the field butterflies behaved as they did. Yet everyone would say that they understood completely, and with textual references and secondary sources even. Despite the disappearance of the poet, the poems remained, stayed on, living their same previous, private, unread, anthologized, shelf-ridden lives. And this is a beginning. And it's from a chapter titled February Fooled the Forsythia. It was during that odd hour of twilight when the valley was infused with the glow of another, more beautiful world, when everything was bespeckled with golden dust motes wandering in their own celestial promontories, that everything, the curling bark of the sycamores, the fields of roughly cut grain, the patches of sweet alfalfa-filled cow flops, seemed lovely enough to die into. You could try to recreate it, just as you try to recreate love anywhere. But here, I have to look up after a late day rain, when the clouds have heaved away and the last light of day fractures the sky, to say, oh, don't the buildings look lovely, lovely? Then the suggestion of a malignant entity shattering the scenery. I could never make it just right. The eggshells too thin, the butter too cold, the breakfast nothing but a sordid misunderstanding. I only wanted a few things, a white pitcher, a vase of pink peonies, a body of water, a double-barreled shotgun, the croaking of bullfrogs, a flower garden, a grove of lilacs, fresh eggs, a view of mountains. If we began behind sheer curtains, underneath thinning sheets, in a bed two sizes too small. I know the hunger of the hunted. I thought it would be best to leave you then, but for the... And this is an ending. Insistent larks. One can certainly surmise how it was taken to be a representation of life. November would be gone soon. The woods, so thin, so scarce, and the unraveling of the maiden's scarf all point to the sparseness of the thin chimney plumes in the distance. Judging by the ice, so thinly conveyed, the couple, in another life, in another painting, would soon hear the thunderous splitting apart, the heaving of breaking apart. And this is a beginning. The decoder ring spelt out forbearance. If I wanted this, then I wanted this last week. Doctors have a way of making you believe that everything will be okay. Therefore, doctors have a way of making you love them. In the dream, the doctor held the instrument that listens to life against my heart. I sent a telegraph to a cloud, and out came 1,000 souls. The telegraph said, forbear. You may not know this, because you probably have never had to know, but I know it because whatever it is that I am doing, I am always interested in something else. When you dream of a telegraph, it means that you are not about to receive, but will deliver an important message soon. When a star dies, it still exists. It is only said to die because it no longer gives light. So too do I wonder about our living selves. Do we begin then sometime much later to give off light? The star still exists. Some stars, such as quasars and pulsars, will continue to give off signals. Such colossal amplitudes of last life, a lifeline showing up on no screen, continuously beeping for a celestial doctor who does not come. Some dead stars, like black holes, we know exist simply because of the behavior of other bodies around them. Their gravitational forces continue to attract whatever happens to live near enough to be propelled closer to them. So do I behave in such a way that suggests that someone I loved once still exists? What the unsuspecting body does not know. Once there is a pool of attraction, there is no departing, no leaving, and thus one gets crushed into a singularity so astoundingly dark and heavy that not even light can escape. The star chart spelled forbearance. In the dream, there was an astrolabe that continued to point the way. Strange that in dreams, there exist some machines that cannot be or would not be used while we are our wakeful selves. I used a strange mechanism. And this is an ending, and it's the last one I'll read, and it's from an epilogue of a hypothetical book. And throughout the book of beginnings and endings, there's this running narrative about a dead author named Genevieve Abouli, which just happens to be very close to Jenny Bouley. There's no correlation. So Genevieve Abouli had this quilt that she was making, and her granddaughter discovered in the quilt, in the squares, Genevieve Abouli had left poems in these quilt squares. And so this hypothetical epilogue is listing what was in some of the quilt squares. Epilogue. Instead of bagloom, when real happiness, when real bliss, when I point to a sunset and say something about awe. Quilt square number 479. How is it that seasons change? Do they change so slowly, so creepingly, because we so rarely break away from whatever it was that we were dreaming to notice? What the season brings us to suffer, because seasons, no matter how lovely, will bring us to suffer. It brings when we are not looking. I know the look of a cracked landscape, winter in black and white, flat and finite with the sunset on the horizon like a red heartbeat suffering there. It will take me longer each morning now to go out and face it. The leaves shivering, then falling about, as if to remind that somehow, despite leavings, there is some magic, some beauty there. I don't want it, the mountain view, the shimmer of summer rain, a trout-filled creek. How is it that I came to be here this way with the wind, a suggestion that it was, indubitably was, autumn already and again? What I want was in bed. He kissed me and said goodbye, and already at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the world takes on a stormy look. Quilt square number 480. I know the forest creatures are in hiding from some great unknown terror, a creature which is, in actuality, a mere shadow. I too go into hiding at the suggestion of darkness, of plot, of fullness. Do you know what happens before arriving here? The hyacinths really are just hyacinths. The color of the sky really is not the shade of blue you'd like it to be. I know the strangeness of animals that know only light and dark, sleeping and waking. The hand that cuts you free from the cloth is not necessarily the same hand that sews you back in. I too have a scissors aimed at the sky. I too will slice open the belly of a great heaving. All right, thank you so much.
That was beautiful. Thank you, Jenny. It's your poetry is so sensual and inspiring and leaves me speechless. So now we have another absolutely gorgeous poet who's going to be reading for us. We're, I think tonight I don't want to say special, but it is. I don't know what other word to use. I've known Simone for many years, and I've attended many of her readings, and every time is a great pleasure hearing her read. She's one of the most beautiful poets in Chicago, not only as a poet, but as a woman, and I feel that way. Jenny and I met tonight for the first time, and I feel the same way. It's just a great honor. So Simone Munsch is the author of The Air Lost in Breathing. She won the Marianne Moore Prize for Poetry in the year 2000. Lamp Black and Ash, Morton Prize for Poetry, and Orange Crush. I think you're going to be reading from Orange Crush tonight. She's a recipient of a 2000 and 2009 Illinois Arts Council Fellowship, the 49th Parallel Award for Poetry, the PSA's Fine Lines Contest, the Charles Goodnow Award, the AWP Intro Journals Project Award, the Poetry Center's 9th Annual Juried Reading Award, which we actually had last week, and the PSA's Bright Lights Big Verse Contest. She received her PhD from the University of Illinois at Chicago and now directs the writing program at Lewis University, where she teaches creative writing and film studies. Additionally, Simone serves on the advisory board for Switchback Books and Universe, a United Nations of Poetry, and is an editor for Shark Forum. Simone, welcome.
I, of course, want to thank the Poetry Center. I love this space. It's such a beautiful space to read, and so thank you for having me and for such a lovely intro, especially to you, Erica. And also I want to say I've been a fan of Jenny Booley for some time now, so I'm very pleased to be able to share the stage with her. And her last piece segues nicely into what I'm going to read. I'm going to start with new work and actually work backwards. But my new project, her piece about the quilt containing squares of poems, I'm working with a form called the Cento, which is a patchwork form. And this is for my students who I've all forced to write Centos and who are here as well. But it came about, I'm interested in collaborative work, and I've done collaborations with two Chicago poets, Philip Jinks and Bill Allegreza. And this is a new type of collaboration in which I'm collaborating with pre-existing texts. So I'm grafting other people's lines together to grow something new. And this series is called Wolf Centos, and they're all just titled Wolf Cento. I have looked too long into human eyes. I have stood for a long time, like a dream printed on paper, while all the leaves leaked gold as the wolf sang once again, nerves sprung and half electric in the dark tree of the self. You will always be at some border of a blue blade, a lunar landscape of wounds, a river net of anatomy, your animal companion. Show them the marks left where you merged. Wolf Cento. We are looking for a way to live. Frail orbits, green tries, games of stars, and on this dial the condor's shadow as the she-wolf of these clouds tumbles down through cloud, through stricken dawn dark between vineyard rows, stunned by gold, we see coming in full gallop at vertiginous speed the last sun. With her teeth, the she-wolf reaches the blonde braid of a star, a thing of gleaming strands, a radiant evanescence. The blue dog's paw lick the droppings, dew opening beautifully inside my brain, where everything is green like quetzal flowers, or the light in the skull of a bird, or a thousand tropics in an apple blossom. What's there is the endless clear country road, a cold drink before sunset, and then a bed. We are looking for a way to live. Wolf Cento. I saw my life, a wolf, loping along the road, a glint of bone visible and then gone, a landscape altered. Ideas, hair, fingers fall and come to naught. A shirt blows across the field. A shrug of stars as flowers go out on the sea. Maybe the whole world is absent-minded or floating. The flower, the weather, the room empties its mind of me. The sea pulse of my utterance. I have stood for a long time at the edge of a river, nameless, unknown, hands groping for the shape of the animal, not knowing what all the music had been hiding. And this will be the last one I read. Wolf Cento. Nothing remains of you. The city rotates in the canal's fluorescence, caught between the reins of obese trees, dripping a thousand sugars and whorls of more carnal flowers. I go out to the road and listen to this fouled landscape that sunk into itself. Wolves yawn in front of the open cage. Nothing glistens under the arcades. In the parks, electric light breaks through the branches. A man waves from his spandex biking outfit. Everything else is hushed like a much hunted animal fixing us in her eyeshine. We live in a world of motion and distance. No matter where we go, we always arrive too late. And whatever houses we return to and this stuffed masquerade, we are at a party that doesn't love us. And I'm going to switch to Orange Crush, which is a much different book. And I'll start with this poem called Psalm. And the book came about, I guess I should give you sort of the concept of the book. The title, Orange Crush, had to do from this literary trope of a figure called the Orange Girls. And as I began to research them, I realized that not only did they exist in my spam, which I was receiving daily, but they were a historical figure from Restoration London, which were young girls who sold citrus in theaters to keep themselves alive. But throughout history, and even at the time, it became a euphemism for prostitution. Psalm. Fever-damaged girls light up in a row, spells and vixens and dead calico kittens. The convent said fire, the fire said kindness. Kindness took a victim, bone bonnets for the little girls sleeping and blue beds for their snapped necks. A kiss is a bite, is a bit, slit in the clouds above a slit throat, a black coat and a black glove went missing. One girl was fallen in cold golden light, girl killed by frost, a man's hand on her starched white collar, undone and saturated with woodburn, while snow descended like laudanum. Doctor, come quick, the little girls are sick, their voices muffled by smoke and wool, hands and psalms. Hurry, hurry, it's the eclipse, the girls aren't breathing, and the chapel is leaking. Doctor, come quick, someone's a heretic, someone's a witch. Young women carrying baskets of oranges used to stand near the stage in London theaters and sell oranges at 6 pence apiece and themselves for a little more. Between dresses, we came. Between naked and nothing, we slipped into the delirious coils of perfected ears, pear dust on our skin, sarsaparilla sounding our fizzied song in sailor mouths. We were translated by church women who placed umlauts over our words. When we recovered, we were sold in beautiful clothes, sent sailing into the gulf where the moon pitched its lemon lateness over the celluloid slickness of sea. We were movie stars who never entered the frame. We were green and gone, lisping O-words in the air, ode, odalisk, obituary. The rind of the orange is hot and the meat within it is cold. There are only 2 ways to peel an orange, in fragments or in one coiling brightness. Let us rewind and revel in the orange aid of sun-decked eyes. Turn me spinning in a carousel sweet dress, earmarked by radio teeth, red leaf breath. Your arm is on fire as we ride in a dark car to the carnival, the constant clink of seat belt to belt buckle, the sky's cotton candy melting in a girl's cold mouth. A cause between an orange wife and a forest seller. Hunter, I hand you a red sweater, whisper of precipitation, trigger happy laughter in the light latticed forest. You burn my nightgown to undergrowth in this feral season. Overseer to all small deaths, your lips an orange smear of cordiality. Your rifle's leverage cocks your spine. My skin is soft, the safety's off. And then I'll read the close to this particular series. She slipped out of the Moorish gate and into the orange grove. On days when the air is seawater taffy and glittering surfaces are coated in kerosene, one refrains from saying bedclothes for fear of causing hospitals and courthouses to flame. A proliferating scarlet, an utterance uncontained. Summer and sentences trickle down our backs as we gather driftwood from the river to build a house that cannot hold us. Like riddles and diseases, we are a multiplying sigh. We are fevered with fervor and red liqueur, the wax of sealed envelopes. The fact is, we disappear as departing footsteps, orange girls blazing through doors of sugar water and fire. And I'm going to switch to Lamp, Black, and Ash, and I'm just going to read 2 poems from this book. I'm going to read the opening because I also feel like I collaborate a lot with film images, and this is in response to a line from Eric Rohmer's film, Claire's Knee, but it ends up really being about the act of writing poetry, and it's called I'm Like You, My Dear. I'm like you, my dear, a leafleteer of belles lettres, a fan of Lentissimo Doloroso, leeks and lemon verbena, a funambulist with zero visibility. I'm blue sugar on the lunar line, iron pyrite and diamondbacks, luminescent, nascent, a shell pink shack. I'm the lot you draw, the hammock where you sip elixirs in exile, where whitetails forage the yard, tearing up dog-tooth violets, a geography of gypsum and hooves. I'm like you, my dear, though you're a fig tree borer, and I'm a goldfinch watching you funnel your way through my home. Like Virga, you disappear before I even reach your shadow, though you leave a residue, texture of red falling across the unsung country of Arkansas, light like a woman's sleeve sweeping over the field. I'm like you, my dear, just a little too near the Scylla, sea level and singing a cappella. And this will be the last one, and it's called Or, O-R-E. Sing me a least harmonic song, a song that is fierce to the ear, and read to me in French, Creole style. Hurricane at the back of your throat, slurring vowels, Paris slick and soyeur, are smooth as water in a well, no impulse to lean into your own reflection. Hand over yourself so that I might hand it back to you. In the kitchen's darkness, where touch is located in smell, finger to lips, manzanilla olives, knee to knee is salt and cough of pepper, hand to hip is amaryllis blooming in the window like a fire show. Odor of La Vida Dolcetto and snow, its milk glass glazing trees, glinting in the margin between stoplights and stars. To hell with mysticism and ghost and vapor, I want what I can grasp onto, dig into, loam, a layer of clay beneath skin, mud stiffening our hair until we are statues of dirt, small cuts on our bodies so that we may wash and heal, so that we might seal the foul and the fair together. When we ransack one another in a field of lobelia, milk vetch, while turkey vultures inch closer, sniffing us out, smelling blood on us and breath on us as they fly back to the fringe of the field and wait as we bite and bleed, taut in cobalt dark beneath a rain that falls like pollen and rusted chains. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. That was beautiful. So now we're going to do our question and answer.
Ask you guys a question first, and then we'll open it up to the floor if anybody has questions. For my name is Jem Hilton, I'm programs assistant here, and I had a couple questions for you to get things started. So I didn't want to ask the basic question of why do you write poetry, but I did have a specific question for Jenny. I think I asked you this a little bit earlier, sort of, but I actually wrote it out because I was really curious. Your book of essays that you were reading from today, it seems inspired by all sorts of things that are not part of the literary canon, for example. It seems to, you know, reference the physical and environmental sciences, speculative philosophy, all sorts of very esoteric subjects. So in some ways it seems like you're taking like a critical stance toward the topics that you're engaging with, like the physical sciences, or when you're talking about, you know, experimental physics and probability theory. So in any way do you feel like you're critiquing the genre in which you're writing in by writing in that genre, by taking up sort of the stance of a mathematician, but in a poetic way? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, thank you for your question. It's very thoughtful, and it helps me to see my project in a whole different light. And I think that there are moments in the composition where I felt that I was being a little subversive, but there were also moments in the composition that I felt that I was really trying to celebrate a form by mimicking it, because I think mimicry, I think, is definitely an act of homage and an act of, you know, paying tribute. So, you know, I'm just thinking of, you know, Aristotle's Poetic, when he talks about, you know, mimicry being in some way how we imitate the gods, and by creating, that we create by mimicking. So I think that, you know, this book is a bit of a ventriloquist feat in that way, that, you know, I was trying to at times mimic the type of writing or you know, the type of discourse that's engaged in some of these stances in the book. Yeah.
I thought it was cool, so I was just curious on your take. I feel like Chris Farley, when he's interviewing Paul McCartney, and said, that was awesome. Simone, I have a question for you. So I was hoping that you would expand on some of like the moral or political themes in your work, especially in Orange Crush. You know, I wouldn't say it's overtly political, but it definitely seems to have a political message as far as giving voice to, you know, forgotten women throughout history. So do you think in some sense that in working within the form of poetry, you're able to say things politically or morally that perhaps other media would not be able to express? Like if you were just to write a straightforward essay, you know, why it's bad to silence women's voices, for example, or...
Hoping I get the easier question.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, for me, writing any poem is a political act, especially as a woman, because it gives you a voice. But in this particular book, I was trying to give voice to a lot of women throughout history that haven't had a voice. And so it tells other people's stories, and it is a gender division, which isn't to say many of my male friends have been preyed on as well, but in a different way. And, you know, I'll have these conversations with my classes, and I'll mention something about going running and a guy pulling up beside me with his penis out. And all the women in my class will be like, oh, yeah, that happened to me 2 weeks ago. And I think men are somewhat stunned that this happens to us so frequently that it just becomes an anecdote, right? I have about 40 of these anecdotes, penis anecdotes, that aren't sexual. They're horrifying. And so in this particular book, I was able to give voice. I was watching, and this may seem silly to some of you, but in terms of political platforms. For me, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is a fabulous political platform, and I think it's a brilliant show. And so I was watching Buffy, and it absolutely informed this book in terms of what I could do as a writer. Because if any of you watch Buffy, one of the things why it's so significant is the obvious, which it gives rise to a new form of female agency. But more significantly for me, it's the dialogue. It's very interested in language itself. And now I'm rambling because I've lost, because your question was so long. But I think it's a fine line, though. I kind of cringe at the word political, because in poetry, because it always reads like propaganda. But I would like to say, I'll just close with an anecdote. One of my students came to me and she's like, yeah, I took your class because I heard you were, and she wouldn't say the word. And so finally I filled in the blank and I was like, go girl, go? Is that, you know, kind enough for you? And she's like, yes, thank you. And I was like, well, what you want to say is you're a feminist. And she's like, yes, but I didn't want to offend you. And I was like, feminism isn't a dirty word to me. But it was just interesting in terms of generational gap. But I do feel that that word has been used, applicable to Orange Crush, not the other book, as both a way to dismiss it and as a way to sort of valorize it.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't want to continue on. Does anybody in the audience have a question or comment for any of the poets?
I think when you've talked about your poetry, the crush, for instance, you said you note it, is a pivot word. It covers a lot of aspects of what the topic of that poetry is. But there's also a sense of a tension between sensuousness and exploitation. And you once said there the ideas of eros and violence get cross-wired, is a term you used. Do you remember saying that? And do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Well, I was trying to write about or speak to this idea that why women are sometimes in abusive relationships. That's what I believe the quote came out of. And, you know, the simplicity of, you know, as a kid, when you have abusive parents, somehow your ideas of love and violence get cross-wired in your brain. So there's a sense of the cyclical. There's not much eros in Orange Crush. There's a lot of eros in Lamp, Black, and Ash, which is an homage to the French surrealist Robert Desnos, who died in the death camps when he was 44. But Orange Crush isn't dealing with eros. It's dealing with the multiple binds that women find themselves in continually and how we work ourselves out of those binds. And on a very personal level, there is a poem in there that makes a brief allusion to the fact that I had cancer and I went through chemo and radiation. And if you ever experience the medical industry as a woman, there's another bind you find yourself in. And I kept it in that book because one of my women readers said, well, you need to be one of the orange girls as well, as a way not to just exploit them. And so in that way, I became one of the characters in my own book.
Hi, this question is for Johnny. We were talking a little earlier before your reading, how much your poetry reminded me of the poetry of Michael Ondaatje. And can you just tell me about some of your inspirations and how you write and your thought patterns, your feelings when you're sitting down? And I don't know if you're typing, if you're handwriting. Just tell us a little bit about that.
I think I had mentioned to you earlier that the collected works of Billy the Kid is one of my favorite books, and it's a book that I do assign as a hybrid book in a lot of my experimental writing courses. And so it's in me. He's there. But I think that I'm really, really inspired by what I'm reading. And I draw a great source of inspiration by what I'm reading. And I tend to have very varied interest. You know, I find as much inspiration from, you know, a coffee table book as I would from Nabokov. I love to go to used bookstores just to look at old books on various topics, stamp collecting, botany, hosting dinner parties, cocktails from the 20s, you know. So I just love these things. And I think it may be because I grew up in a book with in a house that didn't have any literary books. And I just had a bunch of National Geographics, which of course covers everything, and seed catalogs. And those were my reading sources growing up. So I know a lot about seeds, and I know a lot about orangutans, bonobos. but literary-wise, too, I love reading the classics. I'm one of those people that really loves Moby Dick. I really love Don Quixote. I really love the Odyssey. And I always urge my students to read because I hope that they can pick up on, you know, the same sort of inspiration that I get as well. And, so I often make forays into the texts that I'm studying and plunder them and see what I can do with them. And I guess it's a little bit like some sort of patchwork, you know. So I think I pay homage rather than steal. I don't feel like I steal, but
Well, whatever you've done, it's spectacular. Thank you. And I have a similar question for you, Simone. Tell us about your inspiration, about how you write, how you feel, your thoughts, your you know, what do you do? How does it begin?
I'm as I said before, I'm heavily influenced by film, and so I watch a lot of film, and that leads me to write. So, wonders of Netflix, right? I'll be on my computer with a tiny screen of a movie, and I'll do what the surrealists did, where I'll just go hop from movie to movie, in the middle of movies, at the end of movies, and write via the image. I also, I'm influenced by my students a lot. I'm very fortunate to have wonderful students, and I say that because they often inspire me. We do a lot of collaborative work in the classroom, and I'm always, time permitting, doing the work that they do, because I really don't want them to think I'm assigning them something that I wouldn't do myself. And I'm always amazed at how, if you can get someone's imaginative capabilities open, how wonderful students can influence you. And then I work with a variety of people collaborating. So Bill Alagreza, we wrote a chapbook together. Philip Jinks, we wrote a chapbook together. And then my friend Christy Odalius, who's a fabulous poet. She has a book called Strange Trades, which is with Shearsman Press, which is a UK press. We would trade 20 lines a day. We did it for a summer, I believe, a la the book by Harry Matthews called 20 Lines a Day. And so every morning I would send her 20 lines, and she'd sort of tease out a few of the words from what I send her and send it back to me, and we collaborate that way.
That's actually a great exercise, I think, because it forces you to write. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
After a question about how you write, if you don't mind fielding one about how you read, there are a growing number of poets who, with their readings, have become so successful at the patter that the poems almost become secondary. So there's always the question when you read about how much to explicate. And you both let the poems do nearly all the talking. Is that a reading style that you developed over time, or do you come to that naturally? Was there a time, in other words, where you would talk about the poems at some length and then do the poem and then?
I'll answer first and then I'll pass it on to you. I think when I was an undergrad, I totally noticed that poets did that at readings, and so I thought you had to do that. And so I think I did it for a while until I realized that you didn't have to do that. I don't know. I guess there's also a sense in me that feels that if you have to explain the poem, then the poem didn't do its job a little bit. But I guess, you know, everybody has a different presentation style too. But I really enjoy some of the patter that comes before the poems too at readings. Like I really love hearing about some personal anecdote of a poet's life too. And I guess maybe I'm more shy and reserved and I don't give it away, so I make excuses.
I tend to actually talk a lot before poems usually, and that's in part, I think, because it's a different art, reading versus the page. And so for me, I understand that if people were reading it on the page, they could make connections that they can't just hearing it. So I like hearing context for pieces, and so I like often giving context for pieces. But there's that very fine line where the patter overtakes the poem, and you get this elaborate introduction, and then you get the poem, and you're like, they should have just stuck with the introduction. So, and it varies. Tonight I did some introducing of projects, probably more than the individual poems. But it also has to do with nervousness sometimes. You know, though I'm a teacher and I'm not nervous all the time, occasionally I'll just be nervous. And talking is a way to sort of navigate that nervousness.
I will ask one final question, and then we'll finish the evening. This question is actually for Jenny as well. This is a question about, you have said before that Roland Barthes is one of your greatest influences on your writing. So which Roland Barthes are you influenced by, the earlier or the later, the structuralist or the post-structuralist? Anyway, if you could say something about that.
Roland Barthes. I just love my Roland Barthes, and my students loathe that I assign so much Roland Barthes. I prefer the Roland Barthes who's honest, raw, and autobiographical. When he crosses that line between critical discourse and personal, you know, autobiography. And that's the Roland Barthes that I love, who cannot separate his critical life from his personal life, and they become one. So when he's thinking of a linguistical feat, he's thinking of the feat that maybe he had when he was 20 and in love. You know, and that's the Roland Barthes that I love. So some of those books that I feel explicate that are A Lover's Discourse, Roland Barthes by Roland Barthes, Camera Lucida, which of course starts off as being a book about photography and turns into a book about his mother, and those that would be my Roland Barthes trinity right there.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, thank you very much. I think it's getting a little late, and if everybody would join us at the back of the table, there are books for sale if you're interested in purchasing one. And we also have, if you would be so kind as to sign up for our email list, and we can let you know about further awesome readings like tonight.
And thank you, Jem, for the question and answer. And Simone and Jenny, thank you for this beautiful reading this evening. It was really nice to have this feminine energy in the room. We have some great readings, and tonight was really great. Oh, we've got a couple of things going on. We just had really great news. We're going to be collaborating with, you're going to love this, Amnesty International. And we're going to be, it's in the planning stages right now, but there are poets throughout the world who have expressed their voices. And in many countries, they're imprisoned for it. And so we're going to be collaborating in trying to bring awareness to this and to try to help some of these poets throughout the world. There's one in particular in China that we know about, and there are a few more. So we're going to be calling on you, to Jenny and Simone, maybe to work with us on this really exciting project that we're planning. So we just got the go-ahead from Amnesty International yesterday. So it's we're excited about it, and we've got a great fall lineup ahead, and we'll let you know. Once you sign up, we'll send you emails and let you know what we're going to be doing next. So, and thank you, Cecilia Imbach, Jem, and to our board of directors for everything they've done. They're great support. We've got a really cool board of directors this year. They're all hands-on, and everybody's here. And they are always right here, what can I say? Anyway, thank you again, and we're going to have dinner.